And welcome back. I hope you enjoyed your mindful movement. And we're going to move into our next part of our 30-minute sit. So I'm going to invite you into a practice with RAIN today. And if you're not familiar with RAIN, that's an acronym for recognizing, allowing, investigating, and nurturing. It was originally started with Michelle McDonald from IMS and popularized by Tara Brach. So the N was originally non-identify, which is definitely a Buddhist practice. But I think over time, people really felt the need for nurturing when we're doing RAIN practices. So I'm gonna opt for that N to be nurturing as well. So I'll go ahead and ring the bell once and three times to come to a close. So just allowing your body again to get into a posture that feels supportive and alert. And connecting into the breath. Perhaps taking a few nice big deep breaths and letting go on the exhale of anything that's not serving you, not needed. And feeling into the body, noticing how the body might feel different after the mindful movement. Perhaps scanning the body, allowing the belly to be soft, softening the jaw, softening the shoulders. And connecting into the breath. And bringing to mind a situation in your life that feels challenging for you, or perhaps a place of feeling stuck. Maybe there's concern of fear or shame or guilt or conflict. Maybe something was said that you regret. Conflict with family or friends or colleagues. Maybe even a conflict with yourself. And just taking a moment to visualize this scenario, bringing in the senses, maybe imagining where you were when this happened, maybe taking in the smells, the sounds, contacting the core essence of this challenge. And we'll move into the R of RAIN, which is simply recognizing. Simply recognizing what is happening. What sensations are you most aware of reflecting on this? Recognizing the most predominant feelings and emotions. And you might opt to mentally note them. It could be noting worry or judgment or agitation, fear. Hurt. You might notice happiness or joy or peace. You might notice resistance. You might also notice numbness, where nothing is happening, and that's okay too. Just taking a moment to experience the felt sense of the situation as a whole. Sensing into how this experience is living in your heart, in your mind, and in your body. You might simply whisper the word to yourself of naming what you're recognizing. And just breathing in and breathing out. And we'll move into the A of rain. So we recognize, and now we're moving into allow. And allowing is just giving it some space. In the busyness of our lives, we often don't really give the things the space that they need. We don't take the time to reflect. So just allowing, letting this be. You might say, this belongs. Finding a willingness to pause and allow this to be part of your experience. And you might not like it all, and that's okay too. You're just allowing it to be part of the experience. And if it feels difficult, you can dip your toe in. And dip your toe out, come back to the breath, come back to the body. And again, if there's resistance to allowing this to be here, let that be part of your experience. Feeling into the resistance. Simply noticing what is true, intending not to judge or push away or control. It's okay to have space for this right now, for this short experience. coming back to the breath. Breathing in, breathing out. And we'll move into the eye of investigating. So we recognize, we allow, and the real meat of the work is in this investigation, where we bring gentle attention to the body, bringing a sense of curiosity and kindness. It's kind of a somatic investigation. What's it like for this to be living inside me? You might ask, what am I believing right now? What am I believing when this is going on? How does this feel in the body? Noticing where you feel this experience most distinctly in your body. Perhaps in your gut, in the belly, or in the heart space, in the throat, or somewhere else in the body. Noticing the changing sensations of the body with this experience. If it brings softness or tightness, brings heat or coolness, pressure or achy, squeezing. Just noticing what emotions are here with this experience. You might feel into fear or grief or anger, worry or shame, peacefulness and joy, relief. Maybe there's an emotion under the emotion. Just giving space to investigate that. Noticing what beliefs are emerging as you investigate this. You might ask yourself, is that really true? Is that belief really true? If there's a part of the body that you feel this, or there's a facial expression that you take on with this scenario, you can take on that facial expression or body posture, See if that shares more information for you. Just noticing what's happening in the body. There's changing sensations. What's happening in the heart space? Bringing attention towards the breath. It's a place to land. Wondering if there's more space around this scenario or feels tight. And then moving again into the last part of rain, to the end of nurture. So recognizing, allowing, investigating, and then taking care of ourselves. Asking what's most needed right now. Leaning into your higher self, this wise being. And if you feel like you want more support, I like leaning into the ancestors. Maybe they can provide support, allow you to see what needs to be seen, understand more clearly. Is what's needed to be loved or to forgive or be forgiven? In what style would comfort and love be best delivered in this scenario for you? Being kind and curious, as if you're listening to a friend. With compassion and wisdom. As you listen, taking full breaths into this inner knowing, receiving this wisdom. And perhaps offering yourself a gesture, perhaps a hand on the heart, or rocking or a hug, some sort of gesture of kindness and nurture. With an internal phrase of, I'm here, I'm not leaving. care about this suffering and this challenge. Or feel that love from an ancestor or someone who provides unconditional love for you. Opening up to receiving this care. And just allowing a sense of warmth and light to bathe your whole body in this nurturing. Nothing to do but to receive. And we'll just continue on our own for a few more minutes. Breathing in, breathing out. Bathing in this light and warmth. Just noticing what's here in your heart space in the last few minutes of our sit. Meeting the experience with kindness, gentleness. Thank you for your practice. I know that may have been a little unconventional because it wasn't the normal sit, so I hope that was okay with you all. You had a different experience. And we'll switch into a bit of a Dharma talk now. And what I'd like to share is, it comes from my background as a nurse. So back in 1989, when I first started working, I worked at a cancer hospital in New York City. And I was taking care of patients who had brain tumors and spinal cord tumors. And it was then, even though I grew up in a household that was exposed to a lot of death as a child, and I knew about it, there was a way that seeing it so upfront and personal, it really, really woke me up to the preciousness of life that the Buddha talks about. The Buddha talks about Maranasati, mindfulness of death. And, you know, our ancestors were much more exposed to death on a regular basis. They watched people die in their homes. They would have home burials. And we've shifted that in the last 60 years or so, where we now we send people off to mortuaries and funeral homes, and we're not doing that so much at home. And most people, despite what they would like, are dying in hospitals or in facilities of some sort, nursing homes, rehab facilities, care centers. And we're sheltered from that. So I'd like to share a little bit about how I woke up to mindfulness of death and how that has informed my life. Because I don't bring this topic up to depress you. I actually am bringing this topic up to excite you, because exploring death can really allow us this insight into living our best lives if we let it, if we turn towards it, if we don't push it away. And like so many things we don't like, we push it away. And that's why, you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I just want to die in my sleep. I just want to die peacefully in bed. That's my death plan. But that's not a plan. There has to be conversations and durable power of attorneys and discussions of what your advance directive truly would be, since people can't actually read minds just yet. So for me, I recall even the patient when I was about 20, and I was caring for an exchange student from Columbia University, and she had a leukemia that caused her platelets to be very low, and she had a spontaneous bleed in her head that caused her to become brain dead. And her family flew over from another country. They didn't speak English. She was a bright star at Columbia University. And there was something about seeing this person as, this could be me. You know, just like there's practices sometimes we do, just like me. I want them to be happy, just like me. You know, they're subject to suffering. And there was a way of seeing this person who was my age, seeing that death can come at any time. You know, death is, there's no guarantee. We think sometimes, oh, down the road, I can think about that. But, you know, as you know, there's plenty of young people who have died, and I imagine in your life and publicly, we have many, many challenges with people unhoused right now, and the opioid epidemic, and people dying on the street. And we have, you know, really great examples of like Terri Schiavo in Florida. I don't know if you recall her. There's a new movie on Hulu that's starring Woody Harrelson and Laura Linney, called Suncoast, that the director was actually, her sibling was dying in the same center as Terri Schiavo. So she put together this film to describe her experience in it. So in the backdrop draft of it is the Terri Schiavo scenario of the protest and people fighting for her right to live in a vegetative state, and the political statement between, it went, the Pope chimed in on it, the went to the Supreme Court, the Bush family was in government at the time, so they were commenting and having a say, because there was a disagreement between the parents and the husband. So, and the husband was the point, the healthcare proxy or the next of kin. And so it is really important for us to reflect upon this. And, in the Buddhist tradition, the Buddha recommended to the monks to go out and meditate in cemeteries and to sit down next to the dead, decaying bodies that they found on their travels, and to reflect on their own mortality. And, we can do this as well. We can do this in everyday life, like just as spring is happening, seeing the birth of spring happening, the change of seasons that we say goodbye to winter. I'm here in Wyoming, so the snow is dying in a way. The winter is dying, and we're starting to see the change of seasons with the spring coming around. Or letting your digestion be your practice of looking at the impermanence of food and water going into your body, and the heat, the element of heat, the element of water, allowing that to work on the body and it getting excreted out of the body. And that's, the dying part of that phase. Like, everything can be part of the practice. It can be in the simplest ways without necessarily only fixating on death of human beings as our teacher. And one of my teachers is Roshi Joan Halifax, who's this beautiful person who spent a lot of time working with the dying. And she says this about mortality: there are two ways we can approach the experience of our mortality. One path is based on fear and building a life based on our dread and avoidance of the reality of death. And the other way is coming to terms with the truth of our mortality, going deep into the reality of impermanence and exploring its landscape. Whether it's the passing of the seasons, the death of loved ones, the loss of objects that you really care about, the lessening of mental or physical pain, or the beauty of spring. And so, really, realizing the truth of impermanence is one of the most important awakenings that we can find freedom from suffering. That can be our practice to take on, even in our sit. Even in our mindful movement, noticing the changing nature, noticing, oh, the breath showed up this way when I started. Now there seems like there's a little bit more flow, or there's a little bit more ease in the breath, or not. Maybe there's more resistance in the breath. Noticing the changing nature of that, noticing the changing nature of our thoughts and emotions. Particularly, like when we did that rain practice, for some of you, maybe things sort of evolved and loosened up. And maybe for some others, things got a little bit more fixated. And just seeing that everything is changing. So, pointing that to part of our spiritual practice, to practice with that impermanence, encountering our mortality, that it's not simply about the end of things, but it's actually about using that to let our lives be lived in the present moment, letting that be our teacher. So even with practicing with the breath, when there is a sense of dis-ease or discomfort or more resistance, like practicing when we're sick is a really great time to practice. I've had many students say, "Oh, I couldn't sit because I was sick." And I say, practice. Even if it feels like it's not a successful, quotes, sit, or you don't feel good about it. When we are sick and we don't have a lot of control over our circumstances, or maybe we're alone in a hospital at some point, it's really great to have been able to practice under conditions that are not, oh, I'm on my cushion, I've lit my incense, I have my my altar in front of me, to be able to take that practice with us under challenging circumstances. And I was in a very challenging circumstance about 7 years ago where I mentioned this to Carlita, that I'm an active travel guide, I said earlier, and I was sent to the Caribbean to lead a hiking trip, and I was doing some research on the trail, and I was fortunately with another guide, but I took a normal step, and due to erosion, and those of you who are in California, you probably know what I'm talking about, how there's so many mudslides, but I just took a simple step and the whole earth went out on me, and I free fell 30 feet and fell on a dry riverbed, and I broke 18 bones in that one fall. Somehow this hard head of mine did not lose consciousness, but it was quite an event. And right like that, my practice was there. Loving kindness showed up, and my friend was able to attend to me briefly, but he had to go get help. So he left me for about an hour and a half or so, and I was practicing. And it wasn't like, oh, Eileen, this is a good idea, you should practice now. It just showed up. And it showed up because I practiced for a long time, and I practice under like less than ideal conditions. So I encourage you, when you are sick, to let that be your teacher of like really just breaking down and getting curious about the breath of like, oh, the right nostril feels really congested, or oh, the head feels tight and full, or my ears are clogged, and let like really get curious about what's showing up in the body, and then noticing the changing natures of that, noticing or when you're coming out of an illness, noticing, oh, I'm feeling a little bit better today, or I'm feeling a little bit sicker today, or breaking down the big part of a new diagnosis to just, okay, what's here now in the sensations of the body? So it doesn't have to be this big, massive, overwhelming experience, but it could just be like, oh, I'm noticing aching or pulsations of the body, and it doesn't have to be all consuming. So, I know that it's been a privilege of mine to be in intimate moments with my patients over the years, and in critical care and oncology and birth. And I've been with people at the most intimate moments of their lives, which I feel really grateful for. And I know that that's not an opportunity for everybody. So, how do you practice Maranasati? How do you practice mindfulness of death if you don't have this opportunity to see people of your age dying in front of you that wakes you up? We have these things that are called the five remembrances. Is that familiar to some of you? See some head nodding. Yeah. So I really appreciate Thich Nhat Hanh's version. So I'll just share them with you. He says, I am of the nature to grow old. There is no way to escape growing old. I am of the nature to have ill health. There's no way to escape ill health. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape death. All that is dear to me and everyone I love are of the nature to change. There's no way to escape being separated from them. And then the last one, my actions are my only true belonging. I cannot escape the consequences of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. And so just breaking that down of like letting that be part of your practice of letting just leaning into learning about aging, learning about death, and letting that inform your living. So it's like, as you're aging, you're seeing changes in the body, changes in the skin. Maybe you're granted new diagnoses. Like, I've been granted osteoporosis and cataracts now. And I'm like, am I old enough to have cataracts? Apparently, I am, And so like letting that in, knowing like, okay, these are aging eyes, these are aging bones. The skin is aging. letting that be, letting that be part of the process of accepting that it's fortunate. We're fortunate to be given the gift of aging when others haven't. And that I'm of the nature to have ill health. There's no escaping ill health. Like, really just having some humility for the body when it's sick, and knowing that the body does know how to heal at times, depending on what's going on. Obviously, there's times when you need intervention, but just letting that be part of your practice of, oh, this is a body that's sick right now. Oh, okay, and there's varying levels of sickness. So noticing the changing nature of the sickness, and then just accepting the fact that we're of the nature to die, that death is certain. It's absolutely certain. Death and taxes. If you haven't done your taxes, they're coming up. So, yeah, knowing that all beings in the past, regardless of wealth, regardless of, whatever, everyone gets to die. Sometimes death comes at the moment of birth, which I've been unfortunately present for, where someone births their baby and the baby doesn't survive. Sometimes death comes at the end of a very long life. And, we can even bring that into our practice of when we're practicing our breath meditation, just knowing, like, in this moment, right now, there are babies taking their first breath, and realizing, like, the preciousness of that. And right now in this life, there are people who are taking their last breath, and to be present to that, and knowing, there's people who might not. They might go to sleep and not expect tomorrow they're not going to be here. And that there's all different ways that that will happen for people. And we have no idea. Even if we have a terminal illness, we can die with an accident, today, potentially. And so allowing that to be, as Carlos Castaneda says, letting death live on my shoulder, letting my decisions be informed by the preciousness of this life. And then the fourth one of all that is dear to me and everyone I love are the nature to change, and there's no way to escape being separated from them. I find that that's like the biggest challenge, It's we might come to accept aging and death, but the heart has loved. The heart has loved, and when we're separated, there's so much grief. And we want to, of course, turn away from that. So, how do we practice with that? And we can practice, of course, with our possessions and, letting go of our beliefs, letting go of all the things that we hold really tightly. But it's, I think the loved ones is the hard part. And then really the last one is all about the Dharma. My actions are my only true belonging. I cannot escape the consequence of my actions. My actions are the ground upon which I stand. So it's like, what kind of legacy are we leaving behind emotionally? And I don't mean that in a financial way of just, when my mother died, she died about 2.5 years ago. And I was with her at her bedside, and she sent cards to everybody. So that was like a big part of her legacy. Even people, they would be like her children's friends that maybe she met once, and she'd say, I need that address. I got to send a birthday card or an anniversary card or, and that was a big part of honoring her life. People would talk about, oh, she was full of love, and she had those handwritten cards that we really felt that love come through. We talk about eulogy versus resume virtues. It's like, yes, has this life been a life that's been spent at work building our resume virtues? Or is there something like, even if it was a big part of our work was our eulogy, but how did we treat the people that we worked with? How do we, how do we show up every day to meet the people that we come into contact with? And James Baldwin has a quote here. He says, if you can live in the full knowledge that you are going to die, you can live. This is not mystical talk. It is a principal fact of life. If you can't do it, if you spend your entire life in flight from death, you are also in flight from life. So that's really a powerful statement. And this goes back to how really looking towards death, turning into death, can inform our living. And if any of you have received a serious diagnosis or lost someone close in your family or friend network, you know that that just shakes our world. It wakes us up from autopilot mode, and suddenly we are back in touch with that preciousness of life that the Buddha spoke about. And so we act differently. But can we do that without needing to be shocked out of our system? Can we do that without getting that diagnosis? Can we do that without being prompted? And so, you know, I know this is often a scary topic for people. So, you know, I think you dip your toe in, you dip your toe out, you use all things, you know, like when the goldfish dies, or, you know, as we talked about the changing seasons, and where you see a famous person dies, like apparently O.J. Simpson died today. Did anyone hear that? Yeah. Yeah, so he died today. And of course, like, that brings up the white Bronco and the, oh, I remember where I was and blah, blah, blah. But it's like, okay, yeah, well, I wonder what that was like for him. And probably there's people who have strong emotional feelings about that. But you can use that example, like the example in the news every day. Of course, what's going on in the war, with the opioid epidemic, maybe reading some obituaries, particularly like if you have obituaries in your small town, or, you know, you can read loved ones, friends of family, and then open that up for discussion and just say like, oh, what do you think that was like? Or do you think they were happy? Did you think they lived a good life? Like, in any way, just to open that conversation up, that's just like dipping your toe in. You don't have to take a course. You don't have to dive deep into it. You can just like lean in a little bit and know, okay, well, yeah, if that was me, what would be really hard about that? Like, what would it take right now, like reflecting on your life, what would it take for you to live in a way that you could look back on a life well lived? You know, what is it? Is if you died today, would you feel like you've had a life well lived? Do you feel complete? Or do you feel like there's some work to be done with some relationships or some work to be done with yourself? What would it take for you to die in peace? Those are like some of my favorite. I know I'm pretty warped because I do teach death and dying. So I'm sure you have other reflections you think about. But to me, they're reflections that let me live. Like Bronnie Ware, who she's famous for speaking of the regrets of the dying. And it's, I wish I had lived the courage to be true to myself, not living the life that was expected of us. And, you know, so many women put aside their desires and their cares and their wishes to take care of family or take care of others. We're just natural caretakers. Certainly as a nurse, that has been a familiar theme for me. But I am living a life that's aligned with my true self. And then the second one she talks about is, I wish that I hadn't worked so hard. And of course, that's, we have to pay the rent. We have to get food on the table. We're caring, especially if we're providing for others. So that is a balance. But you know, does it need to be to the degree that it is to the degree that we're working? And then her third one is that I wish that I had the courage to express my feelings. So for some of us, that requires a bit more courage to find our vulnerability, to lean into that. And her fourth one is, I wish I stayed in touch with my friends. And that's a really important one as we age and we lose our loved ones, we lose our friends. Because loneliness is a real It's a real health factor. I mean, it's beautiful that you have this gathering here together to greet this women's sangha, but there's so many people like who are living a lonely life and don't have friends, and it's remarkable to me what kind of friendships can occur on Zoom. I mean, I've been just blown away. I'm still friends, very good friends with people who I've never met in person, who I know since March of 2020, when Zoom became a common name in our lives. So staying in touch with friends, and then the last one was, I wish I let myself be happier. And so, I don't know if any of those resonate for some of you, but yeah, what would it take for you to be more authentic and share your feelings, let yourself be happy, And Norman Cousin, he says, death is not the greatest loss in life. The greatest loss is what dies inside us when we live. Which, I think sometimes when we're in autopilot mode, that can be how we're living. We're just going through the motions and we're not totally present for all of our experiences. And I think you're so fortunate that you have this mindfulness practice, this Dharma women's group, that you have this to come back to and build these habits of mindfulness so that you can not be caught in that autopilot mode as often. I'm not saying that it's not going to happen, because it definitely still happens for me after a lot of practice. But there's a way of bringing that back to center as a reminder of like, no, I can be present. I can be present for this experience, even though I have five things on my list of things to do that need to be attended to. But can I be present with this person and maybe put the phone down and really show up and listen and be heard and be in community, fully present? And so I want to hear from all of you. So I'm gonna end this and just share a poem by Diane Ackerman, which I really, really love, and she calls it The Great Affair. She goes, "The great affair is the love affair with life, is to live as variously as possible, to groom one's curiosity like a high-spirited thoroughbred. Climb aboard and gallop over the thick, sun-struck hills every day. Where there is no risk, the emotional terrain is flat and unyielding, and despite all its dimensions, valleys, pinnacles, and detours, life will seem to have none of its magnificent geography, only a length. It began in mystery and will end in mystery, but what a savage and beautiful country lies in between."